Today is Friday, July 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The U.S. mission in Afghanistan is coming to a close August 31st.
The drawdown is proceeding in a secure and orderly way, prioritizing the safety of our troops as they depart.
Plus, what was the motive behind the assassination of Haiti's President Jovenel Moïse?
Well, this is the $1,000 question. Who is benefiting from the crime? What is really going on?
We'll have these stories and more next. U.S. President Joe Biden says the U.S. military mission in Afghanistan is coming to an end.
When I announced our drawdown in April, I said we would be out by September.
Biden's remarks at the White House on Thursday came after he and Vice President Kamala Harris met with national security leaders for an update on the pullout.
Our military mission in Afghanistan will conclude on August 31st. The drawdown is proceeding in a secure and orderly way, prioritizing the safety of our troops as they depart.
Joining us now is VOA White House correspondent Patsy Wiedekaswara. So, Patsy, we heard from the president on Thursday that American forces will be out of Afghanistan by August 31st. That is about a week and a half ahead of the September 11th deadline that he said. What more, you know, did the president share about the process of U.S. troop withdrawal?
Well, essentially, the biggest part of his remarks on Thursday was about his justification, right? Why is he doing this? He ordered it in April after concluding that the U.S. has succeeded in its mission in Afghanistan by degrading the threat of Al-Qaeda. This is, of course, the group that attacked the U.S. On 9/11, September 11, 2001. So essentially, what the president said for his justification was that, you know, after 20 years, $1 trillion spent training the Afghan forces, almost 2,500 Americans killed, 20,000 more wounded. He is not sending another generation of Americans to go to war in Afghanistan with no reasonable expectation of achieving a different outcome. Now, this is not the first time that we've heard the president say this. He did say this as well in April. So today's Thursday's announcement was more of a reminder to Americans that this is happening. It's happening as planned, earlier than planned even.
Patsy, in addition to speaking about the withdrawal itself, what else did the president have to say?
Well, he said that the U.S. will continue to support the Afghan military, will continue to provide humanitarian assistance and help protect women's rights. But he insisted that the U.S. did not go to Afghanistan to nation build, and it is the right and responsibility of the Afghan people alone to decide on their future and how they want to run their country. Now, a lot of people are criticizing this. The fact of the matter is that the Taliban is gaining ground. We see a lot of attacks on key cities, and there's a huge concern that the country will fall into civil war and the government in Kabul will collapse.
Right. That is a chief concern of many who are watching what's taking place in Afghanistan. So how did the president respond?
Well, he was asked by a reporter about the assessment or a reported assessment from U.S. intelligence agencies that says, you know, as early as within 6 months, the government in Afghanistan could collapse. The president disputed those media reports and basically said that the Afghan military has what it needs in terms of training, in terms of U.S. military support, equipment, and so on, to do this, to hold the country together. Now, that may be a rosy assessment because right now the policy is that the U.S. will not come and swoop in with airstrikes should, for example, the Taliban attack Afghan forces. Right now, the airstrike policy is to just come in should there be a direct threat to the U.S. and its allies from ISIS and Al-Qaeda. But obviously, this is a work in progress, and the president hasn't absolutely ruled that out. So we'll see what happens in the future. But there's certainly a lot more that the U.S. can do, either keeping the money and support flowing to the Afghanistan military, and perhaps potentially in the future think about using a limited amount of American air power against any big Taliban onslaught.
Patsy Wiedekaswara reports for VOA from the White House. Biden also said the U.S. would continue to make sure that it took on the Afghan nationals who worked side by side with U.S. forces, including interpreters and translators. A day after President Jovenel Moïse was assassinated, Haiti was engulfed in chaos. Authorities vowed to hunt down more of the alleged mercenaries responsible for shooting the president in the bedroom of his own home. Reporter Anne-Rose Schoen is in Pensionville, Haiti, which is just outside the capital of Port-au-Prince, and brings us this update.
It's a weird day. I mean, first of all, some people go out. Some people try to go do some business. Then there was a population that went into houses around the area where the so-called mercenaries were hiding. Some people were brought to the police station. People were gathering around the police station and asking for the mercenaries in order to burn them. Then another crowd was getting together to go to the house of one prominent businessman and in order to get him and to kill him and burn the house. In the meantime, there are reports from the chief of police that the arrestations went up from 2 people to 6, then to 7, and then finally there are videos that circulate with 10 people arrested. And then there is another photo circulating of these people before the assassination attempt, and there are 18 people on this picture. So everything is totally confused today.
Have the authorities led on in any way, shape, or form, you know, in terms of a motive for the death and assassination of President Moïse?
Well, this is the $1,000 question. Who is benefiting from the crime? What is really going on? I mean, and everybody is asking the same question. Everybody is asking, where was the protection of the president? I mean, he was the most protected man in Haiti. How is it possible that this group of people could reach to his house, could detonate his gate, could go into his house, knew somehow the way how to go into his chamber. I mean, he had a safe haven. Who drove the first lady to the hospital? Why did the daughter came back? With whom did the daughter came back to pick up the laptop? I mean, nothing is clear.
Speaking of nothing is clear, have they released any additional information as far as what they believe the timeline of events to be in terms of, as you mentioned, the detonation of the gate and the infiltration of the compound to the execution?
No, there is no official timeline. The only thing that I know from a here witness, somebody that was really living very close by, looked at the clock and heard 2 detonations at 1 o'clock. There was sporadic gunfire before, but then there were 2 detonations at 1 o'clock, and then the gunfire went on for 1 hour, very intensive, and then died down. And that was somebody that woke up with the first gunfire, heard the detonation, looked at the clock, and looked at the clock when it stopped.
Anne-Rose Schoen reports from Haiti. A United Nations investigator is calling for international coordinated action to stem abuse by Myanmar's military leaders against its people. In a report to the UN Human Rights Council, the UN Special Rapporteur lists measures for bringing the country's generals into compliance with international human rights norms. Lisa Schlein is up next.
Human rights investigator Tom Andrews accuses the international community of failing the people of Myanmar. In an impassioned speech to the UN Council, he presented documented evidence of widespread systematic attacks by the military junta against the people of Myanmar. Since the junta's overthrow of the country's democratically elected government 5 months ago, he says military forces have killed about 900 people. He says they have forcibly displaced hundreds of thousands, tortured many, and arbitrarily detained nearly 6,000 people.
Some in Myanmar have lost hope that help from the international community will be forthcoming and have instead sought to defend themselves through the formation of defense forces and acts of sabotage, while some are reportedly targeting suspected junta collaborators and officials. And the junta's pattern of the use of grossly disproportionate force in response will likely lead to an even greater loss of life.
Andrew says the people of Myanmar desperately need the support of the international community to end this nightmare. Yet he says little action has been taken beyond international protestations of condemnation, the imposition of sanctions by some nations, and resolutions by UN bodies. The UN investigator is calling for the establishment of a so-called emergency coalition for the people of Myanmar. The plan proposes a series of 5 key measures he says would impose significant costs on the junta. First and foremost, he asserts cutting off the junta's source of income could reduce its ability to attack its citizens. Therefore, he is calling on nations to impose economic sanctions on Myanmar's oil and gas industry.
Oil and gas sector revenues are a financial lifeline for the junta and are estimated to be close to what is needed for the junta to maintain the security forces that are keeping them in power. They should be stopped. Second, an emergency coalition for the people of Myanmar could outlaw the export of arms to the Myanmar military as called for in last month's General Assembly resolution.
The plan also calls for the pursuit of universal jurisdiction cases and filing charges against Myanmar's senior security officials. Other measures include ensuring that humanitarian aid goes directly to the people of Myanmar and the denial of any claims of legitimacy by the junta, such as the false claim that it is recognized by the United Nations. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. On Thursday, the world surpassed 4 million deaths attributed to the novel coronavirus. Now, since the outbreak of COVID-19 in 2019, we've learned a lot about the virus, who is most vulnerable, how to better treat COVID-19 patients, and how the virus works. Researchers are also discovering how the virus manipulates the body's immune system and evades its defenses. As we learned in this report from VOA's Carol Pearson.
When a virus invades the body, the immune system immediately launches an attack. But COVID-19 seems to be able to fool our immune systems. Michaela Gack is the scientific director and chair of Cleveland Clinic's Innovation and Research Center in Florida. She likens the immune system to a home alarm system that a burglar disables.
Basically, the invader, in this case, the COVID-19 virus, disables the alarm system in the house and thereby can freely, you know, replicate in the human body and spread.
Gack says this happens almost immediately after infection.
Another key feature of this virus is that it can escape the human immune response. This high transmissibility of the virus combined with that it can evade antibody responses really makes it quite alarming.
What makes the virus even more alarming is its more contagious and more serious Delta variant, which is spreading quickly around the world. The Delta variant has become the dominant strain in the U.S. In her lab, Gack's team is studying COVID-19's evasion technique, which she says appears to be unique. She says the technique provides clues for developing medication to fight it.
Targeting this enzyme of COVID-19 of the virus would actually, on the one hand, directly block the virus, but it would also restore or even boost our immune system. So it would have this dual function, what I believe could be very beneficial in terms of therapeutics.
Gack and her team are working with other researchers at several other labs. If successful, they might come up with new ways to treat patients with COVID-19, as well as those infected with another coronavirus, or they might discover new treatments for those suffering from other diseases that start with a virus, such as some cancers. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
As the number of vaccinations around the world increases and countries open up for travel, a new problem has arisen. Many, especially in the developing world, are stuck with vaccines not approved in North America, Europe, or some Middle Eastern countries. That's impacting not just recreational travel, but people's livelihoods. VOA's Aisha Tanzim has that part of the story.
Pakistan received its first COVID vaccines from China and Russia after multiple waves of the virus had already struck the nation. At the government's urging, many people took their shots. But now, Pakistanis are finding that some of the vaccines given in Pakistan are not yet approved in many other countries. About 9 million Pakistanis live and work in other countries. Many are now rushing to get more widely approved vaccines like AstraZeneca, Pfizer and Moderna. But these vaccines only recently arrived in Pakistan and in limited numbers.
Only 300 vaccines were delivered to my area, Mardan. The vaccines were gone in minutes, so I traveled to Islamabad because my visa is about to expire.
Nearly half of Pakistanis who work and live abroad do so in Middle East countries, mostly in United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia. These two countries have only approved certain vaccines. Many laborers who returned to Pakistan for a break are now finding it difficult to re-enter the countries where they work. In a desperate attempt to keep their jobs, some are willing to take multiple vaccines despite the limited medical data on the safety of mixing the shots.
Multiple times, but people come in, we do face that they have gotten a vaccine, some other vaccine before, because most of the vaccines required for travel abroad were not here. But now since they come back to us and they ask us to, like, you know, vaccinate them again, that's one of the major problems that we face.
In early July, Pakistan received 2.5 million doses of Moderna through the COVAX initiative, meant to ease the burden for mid- and low-income countries.
People who need to travel internationally are coming from across the country in search of vaccination centers like this one in capital Islamabad. It offers a variety, and people are hoping they can find the one vaccine that's accepted in their destination of choice. Aisha Tanzeem, VOA News, Islamabad.
China has accused Australia of interfering with its efforts to boost the COVID-19 vaccine program in Papua New Guinea. Phil Mercer has that story.
Chinese state-owned media has claimed that Australian consultants in Papua New Guinea have been hindering the rollout of COVID-19 vaccines flown in from China. It was alleged that they'd engaged in political manipulation and bullying there. Australia has strongly denied claims. It's tried to sabotage China's efforts to boost vaccinations in Papua New Guinea. Papua New Guinea is currently using the AstraZeneca vaccine. 200,000 doses of the Sinopharm vaccine have recently been flown in from China, but have yet to be approved for use by local authorities. A Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson warned Australia to stop interfering with and undermining vaccine cooperation between China and Pacific Island countries. Australia's Minister for the Pacific, Zed Seselja, told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation all international assistance is welcome.
When it comes to the rollout, what we're focused on is just making sure that we are providing as much assistance as we possibly can. If other countries want to provide assistance, that's wonderful.
Papua New Guinea is Australia's nearest neighbour and has recorded more than 17,000 coronavirus infections and 174 deaths since the pandemic began. But it's hard to get accurate figures due to lack of testing, according to media reports. The South Pacific nation has a population of about 9 million. It's administered just under 55,000 vaccine doses, faced with both hesitancy among Papua New Guineans and a lack of supply. Australia has pledged to ship 10,000 doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine to Papua New Guinea every week, along with medical support. It's also promised to donate tens of thousands of additional doses to other Pacific nations. China delivered 50,000 Sinopharm doses to the Solomon Islands earlier this year. The row over vaccines in Papua New Guinea is the latest dispute between Australia and China. Relations have soured in recent years over geopolitical flashpoints, including Beijing's military ambitions in the South China Sea and allegations of Chinese interference in Australia's domestic affairs. Papua New Guinean health officials are trying to stay out of any diplomatic arguments between Australia and China. They've said they're not concerned about where their coronavirus vaccines come from, but just wants sufficient supplies to protect the country's population. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The Israeli army on Thursday demolished the home of a Palestinian American who was convicted of murdering an Israeli citizen in a terror attack back in May. The U.S. Embassy denounced the action, calling it a unilateral move that exacerbates tensions. Linda Gradstein takes it from here.
Israeli troops placed explosives around Muntasar Shalabi's house in the West Bank town of Tor Musaya during the night Tuesday and set off the explosives early Wednesday morning. About 200 Palestinians threw rocks at the soldiers, who responded with tear gas and stun grenades.
Allahu Akbar! Allahu Akbar!
There were no reports of injuries. While Israel frequently demolishes the homes of Palestinians convicted of attacks on Israelis, this case is different for several reasons. Like most of the residents of Tor Musaya, Shalabi is an American citizen and spends most of the year living in the U.S., not the West Bank. In a statement, the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem denounced the demolition, calling on all sides to refrain from unilateral steps that exacerbate tensions and undercut efforts to advance a two-state solution, adding that this certainly includes the punitive demolition of Palestinian homes. The statement said that the home of an entire family should not be demolished for the actions of one individual. Shalabi's family had appealed to the Israeli Supreme Court against the demolition, saying that he spent most of the year in the U.S. and only came to the West Bank for a visit every summer. The Supreme Court rejected the appeal. In addition, Shalabi, a father of seven, is estranged from his wife and stays in a separate room in the house when he visits. An Israeli human rights group also appealed against the demolition, saying that Shalabi suffered from mental health issues and had been prescribed antipsychotic medications. The state prosecutor argued that Shalabi still owned the house and had recently renovated it. He also said it is more important to provide a deterrent against future attacks than that innocent people would suffer. Meanwhile, the World Bank said Tuesday that repairing the damage to the Gaza Strip from Israel's bombing during May's conflict between Israel and Gaza will cost $485 million over the next 2 years. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
South Africa's former president, Jacob Zuma, is in prison. He agreed to be taken into custody after almost 12 hours of negotiations involving him, his representatives, officials of the ruling African National Congress, and senior law enforcement officers. Last week, the Constitutional Court sentenced the 79-year-old Zuma to 15 months in jail for refusing to answer questions at a commission of inquiry into corruption. Zuma then asked another court to prohibit his imprisonment, but that application failed. Darren Taylor reports.
Political commentator Oliver Dixon, who was at Zuma's home at Nkandla in KwaZulu-Natal province, says there were signs late last night that the former president was giving up his fight to avoid jail.
But it was quite clear that the most likely thing Jacob Zuma was going to do was to hand himself over to avoid an arrest. An arrest would be humiliating, an arrest would be a spectacle, an arrest would not.
One of Zuma's most vociferous allies, his comrade in the ANC's Liberation Army, Karl Niehaus, told reporters at Nkandla that the former president was being treated disgracefully.
The South African Police Service wanting to rush in and arrest President Zuma is just a further indication of the vindictiveness against him and the lack of care. We believe
there's evidence before the Commission of Inquiry that Zuma and his allies stole billions of dollars from government corporations when he led South Africa between 2009 and 2018. Zuma maintains he's an innocent victim of a political conspiracy led by the current president, Cyril Ramaphosa. Nevertheless, shortly before midnight, Zuma left his home in a convoy of black SUVs which sped past ululating supporters. He was taken to nearby Estcourt prison to begin serving his sentence. Singabako Nkomalo is a spokesman for South Africa's Correctional Services Department. He says the next step in Zuma's induction to life as an inmate will primarily involve an assessment of his health. The former president claims he's suffering from a variety of illnesses.
All newly admitted inmates are not mixed up with the general inmate population. They get isolated for 14 days. This is to check whether they do not have COVID-19 or any other illness for that matter. And once
Nkomalo says a prison psychologist will also assess Zuma's mental health and whether he's a suicide risk. He emphasizes that Zuma won't get any special privileges. Nkomalo suggests, however, that because Zuma's so high profile, he cannot be jailed among the general prisoners.
What is clear is that all inmates must be kept in a safe and secure environment. Remember, in this particular case, Mr. Zuma is not in a position to go there with the protection that he has been having, you know, as the former state president. So,
Zuma's imprisonment follows days of tension at Nkandla when his supporters, some armed with automatic rifles and other firearms, threaten bloodshed should the police try to arrest their hero. Leader of the opposition Democratic Alliance, John Steenhuisen, welcomes Zuma's incarceration as a triumph for the people.
Mr. Zuma spent a number of months making derogatory comments about the Constitutional Court, making spurious allegations against the justices and various other members of the judiciary. And I think this sends it a very, very strong message that the law won't be mocked in South Africa and that it will be applied. I mean, we have to have that. We have to be a law and rules-based society. Otherwise, you descend into chaos.
Zuma, though, has another shot at freedom on Monday when the Constitutional Court will hear his appeal. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
And finally, people on Spain's Mediterranean coast are grappling with what researchers are calling a silent invasion of sea algae that is threatening its biodiversity, tourism, and fishing industry. Scientists say that the invasive species arrived in the Mediterranean from Asia in the ballast of cargo ships, creating an environmental nightmare. Jonathan Spear narrates this story.
On the tip of the Iberian Peninsula, Tarifa is the southernmost city in Europe. This thin stretch of the Mediterranean separating Europe from Africa is a transit point for whales and a rich fishing ground for tuna that feed on the nutrients of the Mediterranean. It is also a major transit route for world trade, with as many as 300 ships passing through here daily. It is on ships like these that researchers believe the invasive algae has come to create what people here call an environmental nightmare.
I know the sea current well, and in my life I haven't seen anything like this before. Many octopus used to be seen, and now we have seen one or two a year, when before there were many.
The algae's scientific name is Rugolopteryx ocumure. Originally from Asia, it thrives on the seabed 10 to 20 meters deep, has no predators, and takes over crevices where marine species live.
What you see is a blanket of algae. In fact, I have filmed a mullet stuck on top of the algae, spider crabs walking on top of the algae. They are without their caves, without the cracks, which is where they take shelter.
Tarifa is home to 44 fishing boats, and they are in danger of disappearing. They arrive at ports with nets filled with algae instead of fish and end up in the garbage. Tuna are the most prized game fish, but their food source is disappearing. Also endangered is the tourism industry. The algae are a nuisance both for bathers and for those who come here for kite surfing. For divers, spotting marine life has also become tricky.
The algae move with the tides from one place to another. There are days when there are many and there are days when there are fewer.
The algae came from the coasts of China, Japan, and the Korean Peninsula and made its way here in untreated ballast waters of cargo ships. Researcher Antonio Vergara has been studying possible solutions, including having ships clean their tanks before docking at Spanish and Moroccan ports.
bien las aguas de lastre de los buques que operan.
The ships that operate in Tanjamed, Gibraltar and Algeciras Bay should have their ballast waters treated, especially those that come from Asia, the origin of this algae.
Vergara lectures at Tarifa's Adult Education Center, and his work includes finding ways to use the algae to make products such as fertilizers and cosmetics. For Alfonso Beato in Tarifa, Spain, John Spear, VOA News.
And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. Just point your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.